be able to study together for a little while on a Wednesday night. It's a good way to make it through the week, to put Bible study right there in the middle of it like this. Let's have a word of prayer, and then we will dive back into the Song of Solomon. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your continued mercy and grace. We just thank you for allowing us to wake up today, giving us another opportunity to advance your agenda. We appreciate the fact that we have the Bible. Every one of us can have a copy of it to hold in our hands so that we can study your mind at any time of our choosing. We certainly appreciate times of personal and individual study, but we look forward to times like this where we can come together and think together and ponder your goodness and ponder the revelation that you have provided for us to guide us through this world. We appreciate the books of wisdom and the writings of Solomon, the way that you gifted him and blessed him. And we appreciate the Holy Spirit for preserving these things for our edification. As we continue in our study of this particular book, we ask you to bless us, help us to see the right application for our own lives, and help us to make a ready use of them. In Christ's name, amen. All right, good to see y'all. Last week I wasn't here. I think Doug taught the class last week. I didn't get to ask him what was the class about. I'm just curious. About forgiveness. Well, I know none of you need help with that, so I'm not sure why he would talk about something like that. All right. Well, listen, I hope we're going to finish the Song of Solomon today. I think we can. We've made our way to the concluding verses of the book. We've been with this couple for some time now. And if you remember, I just want to go back for just a moment and see where we met them. We met them during the time of their courtship. And we have a rather lengthy section in the book that talks about the time of their courting. And you can see the anticipation that the two of them had for each other. You can see the intensity of their infatuation with one another. And you'll recall that, of course, she had some concerns. She was, in some ways, she was not very confident about herself with respect to dealing with Solomon. And so these insecurities that she had, you can see that he worked very hard to assure her, to affirm that she was indeed worthy and special to him. And so we have that period of time where they were courting. And then we have a smaller section of the three, the way I have sort of divided the book, and it's a typical way, it is a typical way to divide the book. We have a smaller section following that that talks about the wedding. And I think it fitting maybe that that's the smallest of the three sections, because in a marriage relationship, the courting time should be longer than the ceremony. The ceremony is sort of a punctuation there in the middle. And of course, the longest section of the book is what should be the longest part of our relationships, deals with the marriage. But that middle section with the wedding, you'll recall that Solomon makes his entrance. And so there's sort of a grand procession that would be fitting of a person of his station in life. But he made it a point to affirm her in very, very strong terms. On their wedding day, he told her that she was perfect and she was special and she was unique. And of course, he desired to be with her. He invited her to go away with him for their honeymoon, maybe what we would call it. And she was wanting to do that as well, invited him to come with her. And of course, they had the consummation of the marriage. Now, following that, we see that very early on in the marriage, they ran into some difficulty. They had a spat, a problem, a disagreement of some kind. He wanted to come in to be with her, and she wasn't moving quite fast enough for him. And so by the time she had changed her mind, he was gone. And so she has to sort of go on a journey, an excursion to find him. And we see that when they did finally come together again, we can see how quickly they were able to reconcile. And I think there should be something that we can learn from that. Maybe Maybe that lesson on forgiveness, Doug, would be helpful right there. Just our being able to kind of get over some things that don't have to constitute the end of the world. So in continuing on with them in their marriage, we see that they exchange these various tributes, very elaborate tributes toward one another. And there was also this period of time, which I had called, and this is where we ended up 2 weeks ago, her tenderness. Certainly he's desiring to be with her again, and she is reciprocating that. And then she also, though, kind of separately from that, she also expresses a desire to be close with him. And that was the discussion we were having, where she said that she wished that he had been born of the same mother and nursed by her and all of that, and how she wanted to express her affection for him publicly in ways that other people wouldn't despise and so forth. So we've traveled a good way with this couple. And now that we come to these few verses here at the end, this is the last glimpse that we'll have of this couple. And I think that, at least I thought that maybe it'd help us to remember some of the things that we had looked at as we take this last parting look with them. So let's look at chapter 8, and let's just read verses 5 through 14. This is the conclusion of the book. Who is this that comes up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Under the apple tree I awakened thee. There thy mother was in travail with thee. There was she in travail that brought thee forth. Set me as a seal upon thy heart, as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as Sheol. The flashes thereof are flashes of fire, a very flame of Jehovah. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, he would utterly be contemned. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build upon her a turret of silver. And if she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I am a wall, and my breast like the towers thereof. Then was I in his eyes as one that found peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, shalt have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. Thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions hearken for thy voice. Cause me to hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of spices. All right, so let's take a look here. I think I've gone too far. Let's see, this is where we want to start. Sorry about that. These first few verses, I call this a flourishing love, verses 5 through 7 of the conclusion. You can see here that the beginning in verse number 5, the question is being asked, who is this that comes up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? Now, I ascribe that to these daughters of Jerusalem, because that's the group that she's been interacting with throughout the book. And you remember in verse number 4, she says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. So that sort of puts them in the immediate context of the book. Some people ascribe this to a chorus independent of these daughters. I just don't read it that way. So, but I think in the immediate context, that's probably who is speaking here. And they are obviously seeing her coming with her beloved. Now, Solomon has been called her beloved throughout the book, so that makes it pretty clear. The two of them seem to be returning from some excursion. Now, they've been off. You remember, she has said, he has expressed an interest in going away with her. She's made plans. You remember, she sort of had this all mapped out for them to get some time away, and seemingly they have taken the time, and now they are returning together. So that is just the first part of that verse, verse 5. There's the question that is being asked. But then we see a different person speaking in the second part of that same verse there. Under the apple tree I awakened thee. There thy mother was in travail with thee. There was she in travail that brought thee forth. In the English, it's difficult to distinguish these various speakers right here because there are some rapid changes and there's no indication. I'm not a Hebrew scholar by any stretch. I'm not a Greek scholar, but I have a better background with Greek than I do Hebrew. I just read what people who are supposed to have much better background in Hebrew have than I do. And they have indicated that you can tell who's speaking by the gender endings. So it's obvious in the Hebrew where a man is speaking or a man is being referred to or a woman is being referred to. So I accept that. In verse number 5 then, the bride is the one who is saying that she has awakened Solomon. And we've seen that term awaken before. And in the context and all, it does seem that that would have something to do with some physical relations that they had there. So she says, I awakened Solomon under this apple tree. And that would fit as well with some of the things that she described in terms of the places that they might go and so forth. It's interesting what's said here about this apple tree and that being sort of the place where he was born. She says, your mother was in travail under the apple tree. Now, how are we to take that? I read where some people said, well, Solomon was the son of the king, and so there's absolutely no way he was born under an apple tree. It doesn't have to be the case that he was born outside under an apple tree for this to be true. I take that as maybe where they went was close to where he was born, close to his place of birth. Under the apple tree, this is poetic language. It certainly doesn't have to be literal. And I think that may be what is intended there. So they are returning. They've had this private time together, and perhaps the private time was spent nearabouts to where he was born. I think it really interesting if you look at these verses 6 and 7 in particular here. Look at the figures. There are some striking figures that she uses to describe love. Speaking generally about it, let's just take a look at this for a moment. She says in verse 6, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. The seal has to do with ownership. You guys know that. People would sometimes wear a signet around their neck, and they could use that to sort of, you know, whereas we might sign our names or something like that, they could use that to prove their ownership by putting their mark with this signet. And, you know, they could use wax or what have you to press that in. And so that seems to be the imagery that we have here, a seal upon your heart. And then she says, has a seal upon your arm. Well, the other location where you could keep a seal would be on your ring, on your hand, on a ring. And so sometimes you remember reading how the king would have a signet ring, for example, Ahasuerus, he gives the signet ring to Mordecai in the book of Esther. So this is the kind of thing that is being pressed upon us here, the idea of ownership. Now look at these others. Love is as strong as death. Well, that's an interesting one. What does that mean, as strong as death? Well, any of us going to defeat death? Not physical death. I mean, every one of us is going to die. We live long enough. Now, we can overcome death just as Jesus did, but we're going to go through it. And so death is an undeniable force. She says as strong as death in that it is stronger than all. No man is going to overcome it, as in avoid it. Jealousy is cruel as Sheol, or that's Hebrew, referring to the grave. This is a severe kind of jealousy. Now, this is interesting because jealousy is usually used in a negative way, right? But doesn't the Bible say that our God is a jealous God? Doesn't it say that? Well, what is the idea there? It can't be negative all the time if it's used with reference to God and his personality. There is an appropriate kind of jealousy. And it is the kind of jealousy that God has with his people in with whom he has entered into a covenant relationship. There is exclusivity. demanded and required. And if that exclusivity is breached, you get extreme reactions appropriately. Apparently, it's appropriate that God demands that kind of exclusivity. And we see a similar idea in the covenant relationship with man and woman. And that seems to be what is suggested here. Jealousy is as cruel, severe, as Sheol, as the grave. Also, she says, the flashes thereof of love are flashes of fire, a very flame of Jehovah. What does fire do? The Bible says that God is a consuming fire. That's what fire does, doesn't it? It sort of takes over and envelops whatever it is, whatever it comes into contact with. And that's what love does. I mean, she's made mention of being love sick and so forth. And maybe some of you know how that can be. When you have your mind on someone, it sometimes maybe becomes difficult to think about and concentrate on other things. Even when you're trying to concentrate on other things, the thought of that person sort of comes into your mind, and anything that you do and everything that you do, this other person, the object of your love, is always in your mind and your thinking. It is a consuming fire. Also, she says, many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. The idea here is it is unquenchable. Never get enough. Never get enough. And then lastly, she says, if a man would give all the substance of his house for love, he would be utterly contemned or despised, I think is maybe a word in some other translations. So what's the idea there? You can't buy true love. You can't put a price on it. It is a priceless commodity. I mean, it is something, but it's not something you can buy. And so these figures here are pretty poignant in describing love as she sees it. And so that is verses 5-7, this first part of the conclusion, which I refer to as a flourishing love. Now let's look at verses 8-12. Anybody have any questions or thoughts about any of that before we do? All right. Well, let's look at verses 8-12 then. Verses 8 and 9 in particular seem to be a flashback. That is, okay, well, who's speaking? Obviously, this is still the Shulamite speaking, but she is remembering something that someone else has said. She's remembering something that her brothers have said. Now, this to me is interesting because you'll remember she says that her brothers were sort of harsh with her, had her out in the vineyards and so forth, and this was part of the reason for her insecurity in the first chapter. She spent this time in the sun and working in the sun, and so she had been tanned, or skin had been darkened because of that, and that would be indicative of a working class person. She was a maiden marrying a king. He was fairer complected. He had not been working in the vineyards the way that she had. And I think this is interesting because now she's going to talk about her brothers again. But when she talks about them this time, she talks about their protection of her. And so I refer to this section here as preserving purity. Look again at verse number 8. We have a little sister. She has no breast. What shall we do for our little sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? So this seems to be the thinking of her brothers while she's still a young girl, right? She hasn't matured. She hasn't developed. And they look at her and they say, well, we have this little sister. What are we going to do? How are we going to take care of her? How are we going to protect her until the day when she's spoken for? That is, until she's married, until we give her away. What are we going to do? How are we going to proceed? If you look at verse 9, they give you their plan. If she be a wall, we will build upon her a turret of silver. That is a tower. And maybe you guys have seen the turret guns. You know, you can mount the guns on top of something and then you can sort of attack your enemies that way. They're going to build a tower where we can defend her. Then they say, if she is a door, then we're going to surround the door, as it were, with cedar. And so they have taken it upon themselves that they are going to deny other people access to her to make sure that she does, in fact, maintain her purity until such time as she is married. This is interesting to me. I've got two younger sisters. The older of my two sisters is 5 years younger than me, and the younger of my two sisters is 10 years younger than me. The younger of the two had it a lot easier because I wasn't around when she went to high school. But it was my job to protect my sister. So guys would call, you know, and then I'd say, you know, what kind of home training do you have calling our house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? I'd scare guys off. I had permission from the old man to do what was necessary to build a wall around my sister. These guys took a similar kind of approach. We're going to make sure that our sister is protected and that she is safe. You look at the first chapter, and I think, and this is just an aside that's kind of intriguing to me because I do have the two younger sisters, but you can see that in the first chapter there seems to be a hint of severity, right, in how they're treating their younger sister. But looking back on it, there seems to also, this is coupled with their desire to protect her and so forth, and I just think that's an interesting combination. Maybe that's not uncommon between older brothers and younger sisters. In this same section here, they have this. This is her flashback. She thinks back to how her brothers had treated her and what they had done for her from the time she was a young girl. Now, look at it again. She's looking back on it. In verse 10, she says, I am a wall, and my breasts are like the towers thereof. Well, now she's not a young girl. Now she has matured. They were thinking about this time when she was a small girl. Now she has matured and she looks back at all of this and she says, then I was in his eyes as one that found peace. Now who is his? Well, she's thinking about her husband now. You know, now I have grown up and I have matured and I am at peace. I'm prepared. I've been preserved and I am at peace when I finally come to my husband. And in part, that is because there was someone looking out for her. There was someone protecting her and making sure that she would be prepared and preserved and at peace when she finally did marry. I think you can see this even more clearly in these next two verses. Seems like much is made of these next two verses, depending on, you know, what commentator you read, But I think it's pretty clear when you understand the statements that she's just made. I don't think it's all that difficult to see what is happening here. Let's take a look at these two verses. Verse 11, Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. Now, this is not that hard, right? He's got this land and he lets the land out to other people to work the land. And what are they going to do with the fruit, the proceeds? Well, they're going to certainly give him a portion of it, maybe the lion's share, the larger portion of it. It's his land. And in exchange for being able to use the land temporarily, they're able to live on the land and they're able to work the land and they're able to keep a portion that is necessary for them to sustain themselves and also probably sow the field again, right? That's a very typical relationship. She says he has a field that he owns and he requires, he demands this payment from the people. And of course, they would receive some portion of it for themselves. Now she says that she has a vineyard. Okay, he has a physical vineyard And she says, I have a vineyard also, and it's ever before me. Now, her vineyard is a metaphorical vineyard. She's talking about her body, her purity. And she says that she is going to give the 1,000, the lion's share of this, to Solomon. But she's also going to give the 200 to those who kept the vineyard, kept her vineyard. Boy, well, in the context here, don't you see? She's expressing her appreciation for what her brothers have done in protecting her. She has a vineyard, and now she has given the vineyard to Solomon. The fruit, the rewards that this vineyard has produced, she gives to Solomon, but she's expressing appreciation to the ones who kept it temporarily until such time as it was given to him. I think that's really, poignant imagery there, that she can look back at this after some time and have that kind of appreciation for what her brothers have done, what her brothers have done. Sometimes, you know, we don't appreciate what the things that people do to protect us and to prepare us while we're going through it. You know, why do I have to have all these rules and, boy, why can't I do what some other people are doing? Because you don't want to end up like some other people. And when we get to be a little older and we look back at these things, then all of a sudden it makes sense and we can appreciate some of the restrictions, some of them seeming to be severe, but we can look back at those things and appreciate it. And that seems to be what's happening with this young woman here. When we look at these last couple of verses 13 and 14, you that dwell in the gardens. Now, this is Solomon speaking. Now, this is another one of those instances where I say to you, I look at what the scholars say about the Hebrew language and the masculine endings and all of that, or the feminine endings. And so this is Solomon speaking. You dwell in the gardens. The companions hearken or listen for your voice, cause me to hear it as well. So apparently this is where she can be found in these garden areas. We keep seeing that in the book. And apparently there are some people with her who are anxious to hear what she has to say. And Solomon wants to hear her voice for himself. And he makes that request. Let me hear your voice as well. In verse 14, now she responds, make haste, my beloved. And of course, we've seen that beloved is her pet name for him. So that's not difficult for us. Make haste, my beloved, and you be like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains. That is a gazelle or a stag upon the mountains of spices. So she's saying, listen, you need to get here quickly. He still longs for her, and she is still open and inviting to him. And that's the last glimpse that we have of this couple. What do we think? Lessons that we learn, things that stand out to us. Now, we've got the whole book before us now. What do we think about it? Well, I think maybe I do too. He said he thinks he understands it better than he has before. I enjoy it, the book. And every time I go through it, I think I do understand it a bit better. So thank you for that. Thank you for that. Did you have something in me? Yes, ma'am. How much time? Do we know how much time has passed? That's a good question. I'm going to say that we don't know. Now, it is interesting. I read where some people suggested that this closing scene was sort of late in life, right? That's a nice idea. I don't know that there's any way to know that. Which, you know, so they suggest that maybe there's been some substantial time that has passed. And again, I don't know that. I think that you can read the book where there is not a long period of time between what I call the section of her tenderness, him saying that he wanted to be with her and her inviting him away, She said, I've got some places in mind where we could go. Well, this conclusion part comes right on the heels of that, where the daughters of Jerusalem see them coming. So it could be that there's been a very short time. There is no way to know for sure. I tend to personally think that given what we know about Solomon and all of the wives he apparently took after this, that maybe it didn't end up quite this way. I do think that he took several more wives after this. How could it not? She said, well, probably cooled their relationship. And I think maybe, you know, I think 400 more wives would have cooled it. That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, I tell you, maybe the query is, you know, somehow or another, she obviously caught his attention in a special way because he had a couple hundred wives before this. One of the things we got to keep in mind, remember, Solomon's marriages, as best we can tell, were political in nature. Certainly Pharaoh's daughter, I mean, these are women that he's marrying for political arrangements. And there is no indication that he actually actually loves any of them other than this one. We don't have that. So it certainly could have been the case that though he had many wives and maybe hadn't been looking for this. Remember, we kind of mentioned that maybe this is not something that he was looking for, but he wound up being taken by this woman. And though he had all these hundreds of wives, he still said that she was special and unique to him. Exactly why, I don't know, but for some reason or another, she was. And certainly a different context, not as far out as Solomon, but maybe some of us can identify. You know, I've dated, you know, several people in the course of time, and for whatever reason, you know, I'm really taken with this particular woman, and I make her my wife. Hey, listen, I don't suggest that you do it that way. I'm just saying that some of us maybe have.
I think because it's been preserved for us, I think we can understand that it was a special relationship.
That's right. Yeah, I don't. You can read in reading what he says about it. It was special to him, and. You know, 700 wives, he didn't feel this way about all 700. It's just not possible. So this one was unique. Now think about it too. He's all these arranged political type marriages to queens and princesses. And this is a maiden, right? If he loves her, he doesn't love her because of who her father is, and he doesn't love her because of what she can gain for him politically. If he loves her, he has to love her for who she is, because that's all she has. A young girl's been working in the fields her whole life. If he loves her, it's got to be genuine. Yes, sir. Okay. Okay. Says it could have been written especially for her. It sort of has, you know, sort of an operatic feel. And I think that's true. Some people read the book like a drama, you know, with scenes that open and close and so forth. And I suppose you could do that. And maybe you could do that without doing any harm to it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Am I reading that and understanding
it in that way? Yes, ma'am. I believe that is it. She's reflecting on their, maybe these are the words they used, or at least these are the attitudes that they had while she was growing up. Verses 8 and 9.
And that shows that it was
That's right. That's right. Because she says in verses 8 and 9, as she's recounting their thoughts or their words, we have this sister, what are we going to do with her? And they say specifically she doesn't have breasts at this time. So we're talking about a girl who hasn't even hit puberty, right? And then in verse 10, she says that she is a wall and her breasts are towers. Well, Solomon has made reference to her breasts before. So the only point I'm making here is, there's an obvious distinction here, a young girl who hasn't hit puberty yet and a full-grown woman between verses 8 and 9 and then verse 10. So she's clearly looking back at how she had been reared and how her being reared in a conservative, protected fashion prepared her for marriage. And, well, I could do a whole lesson on something like that. There's something to be said for that. Yes, ma'am? Okay. Yeah, okay. I'm familiar with that line that you had to walk, because I had a line for my sisters. The older of my two sisters, just give you the sort of how that played out, because we were a little closer in age. She definitely felt that it was restrictive, and it was, but she dated one guy in high school. They went to college, the same college, married in college, still married today, three nieces and a nephew out of the two of them. And I'm pretty pleased. So I think I did okay on that. Didn't hurt her too much. All right. Questions or thoughts on the book?
Self-conscious, concerned about the way the brothers had treated her, forcing her to work outside and all that. Makes her self-conscious, but then Solomon apparently has done his job and her have that conflict back. She looks back on that as a blessing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Her brothers had made her self-conscious, and Solomon had sort of made sure she had an appropriate level of self-esteem. And you can...
Because of that, she's able to look back on it and say, they were watching.
That's right. She can look back on it and see the benefit. And you know, the other thing that happens here, if you just pay attention to it, her lack of confidence, herself, her insecurities and so forth, over the course of their relationship, that has all sort of changed, right? So when you come to the end, look at how she's talking. She's sort of initiating them spending time together and being intimate and so forth. And she's able to say, well, this is my vineyard and I give it to him. I mean, she's much more confident. And I'm certain that that has to be due in large part to Solomon's persistence in making sure that she knew how special she was to him and how he valued her and so forth. That had to be the case, because you can see how they began, how she began, and the progression that she made. Other questions or thoughts? There is a lot here. There are things that I didn't sort of do because of time, but there's some really good, there's a lot of good application, I think. And so maybe, you know, it's the kind of book husband and wife can sit down and study together, and there's just a tremendous amount. There's a tremendous amount to learn from this couple. Questions or thoughts? All right. Well, that's going to do it. Thank you.